Please come to order. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judges Werke, Conley, Smith, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
Good afternoon, everyone. I keep wanting to say good morning. It is afternoon. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. I'll have a marshal call the next case for consideration.
The next case is A19-1552, State of Minnesota versus Larry Butler.
Counsel, the rules of appellate procedure apply despite the fact we are conducting the hearing by WebEx. When you're ready to proceed, please state your name and the individual you're speaking on behalf of. If you're not speaking, would you kindly mute simply because of the background noise? And I forgot to say, appellant counsel, you do have 5 minutes for rebuttal. When you're ready to proceed, you may do so.
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court and counsel. I'm Adam Lozo, and I represent the appellant Larry Butler. Police suspected that drug sales had occurred at a home in Nantahala, and they obtained a nighttime no-knock warrant. Near midnight, they surrounded the home, lit it up, and with their rifles drawn, approached and broke down the front door with a battering ram. The evidence obtained in the search of that house must be suppressed for several reasons, but the most straightforward is that the warrant did not establish any reason that a nighttime search was necessary, and no exception to the warrant requirement justifies a warrantless search. If this court reaches just those two conclusions, they're the only questions that the court needs to answer. I want to start out by talking about the nighttime search issue. Nighttime searches are prohibited by both the Constitution and by state statute unless a valid nighttime authorization exists. A warrant application must establish reasonable suspicion to believe that a nighttime search is necessary to preserve evidence or to protect officer safety, and that the warrant can therefore only be executed in the nighttime. This warrant application does not meet that standard. The only reason that was stated in the warrant application for the request for the nighttime search was the potential loss of evidence due to overnight drug sales. But the warrant contained no facts alleging or indicating that drugs were or had been sold at night, or of any date at all when drugs had been sold. There was no indication of the warrant of when any drug sales occurred, and certainly no allegation or facts indicating that they had been sold at night. Under the clear jurisprudence of Minnesota courts, specifically the Supreme Court's decision in Jackson, there wasn't nearly enough to justify a nighttime search in this case.
Well, here's what we do have. The warrant says that it's necessary to prevent the loss of evidence from continuing sales of narcotics from the residence. Are you saying because it doesn't allege that these sales are going on after 8 p.m. that that is insufficient?
Well, two things. First of all, yes, that's right. The warrant has to specifically establish a need for the nighttime search, has to specifically allege facts that could lead to a need for a nighttime search. That's in Jackson, the Supreme Court specifically, and this is their quote, specifically rejected the general contention that drugs were being sold from the residence was enough to justify a nighttime search.
Of course, know what I'm getting at. Most warrants just have the boilerplate phrase that say, gee, drugs are sold 24 hours a day. This goes on. We've had surveillance, and I'm kind of mystified why that wasn't included. I'm just saying that it seems to be insufficient, but I don't know if we could extrapolate that from the information about the review of the activity.
Well, I agree that the warrant on its face is insufficient to justify a nighttime search. And I think that one thing that's critical here is that there is not enough, that there's no allegation or facts included in the warrants to establish a need for a nighttime search, no allegation or facts in the warrants that any drugs have been sold at night. And as you indicated, no indication in the warrant whatsoever that drug sales were ongoing or were continual. What the warrant alleges is that on two occasions, without any date or indication of time, that informants alleged drugs had been purchased at the residence. On those bare facts, a nighttime search was not justified under the Constitution.
Mr. Lozo?
Yes, that's right.
So, Mr. Lozo, let's say I share Judge Werke's concerns that, you know, this doesn't seem to have the magic supporting evidence that you generally need. What about the argument that even if it wasn't a valid nighttime warrant, that we still don't have to suppress it because it appears the cops knew that your clients were not in repose, because when they were outside of the mobile home, you know, stuff was happening inside the mobile home that indicate people were not in their pajamas, you know, asleep.
To be clear, there is no evidence that the cops didn't know that anyone was not in their night clothes. There was no discussion or allegation of that. But setting that issue aside, any information that the police obtained about what was going on inside the residence was only obtained after they began executing this search. The police had no evidence or no surveillance, no evidence of what was going on in the home until after they had already surrounded the home, lit it up, drawn their rifles, and were approaching the front door of the home. One of the officer who was the first one through the door testified at the omnibus hearing, and this is reflected in the district court's findings of fact, that he was approaching the front door of the home, and he had his rifle drawn, he was accompanied with the officer with the battering ram at the point when he then observed someone say, as he testified at the omnibus hearing, he believed something about the cops and saw people moving inside the house. So two things are important. First of all, none of those observations of inside the home were made until police had already surrounded the home, lit it up, and were approaching the door to execute the warrant, which is far more than police could do without a warrant. Second of all, just the fact that people were awake and moving inside the house is no evidence, or just the fact that they were awake and moving inside the house does not mean that they were not in a period of nighttime repose. Nighttime repose does not mean sleep. This is clear in Jackson and Jordan. I think Jordan is the one that's a little clearer on that fact, but in Jackson and Jordan, the twin cases, it's clear that nighttime repose does not mean sleep. It just means a period of private activities that take place in the home at night. Police had no information about what was going on in the home. They acknowledged they abandoned any surveillance of it for 3 hours prior to the search. They arrived, they began executing the warrant, and people moved around inside the house. That does not show that they had not entered a period of nighttime repose. And in fact, I think it shows that they had no information that that wasn't happening. The search obviously occurred late at night. It was around 11:30 at night. It was entirely dark. There was no valid nighttime authorization. There was no need established to enter this house at night, and the police did. And that seriously subverts the purpose of the statute. I think it's important to look at, in Jackson and Jordan, what the court talked about as what would show that there was not a period of nighttime repose. The examples given in those cases were the door is open, people are coming in and out, there's a loud party happening. If those were the facts here, that would show that there was not a period of nighttime repose, even if there were people coming in and out of the house before the police arrived. But there was no indication of what was happening, and when the police arrived, they saw none of those facts.
Let me follow up with another question, because you're going to move on to the fact that the court found that there was exigent circumstances to justify entry. Why can't we mold the failure to justify the nighttime nighttime with the no knock, that there was exigent circumstances? Wouldn't we look at that through that lens also?
I guess I might be unclear on what you're asking, but I think
I thought so. Let me say it over again. Okay, so if we agree with you that the nighttime warrant was not authorized, we've lost someone.
Loza.
Mr. Luzo, have we lost you?
Can you see me now?
Yes, I can. Yes,
okay,
I can.
I'm not sure what happened. I'm sorry.
I'll let you go a few minutes over, but here's what I'm getting at. Okay, so if we agree with you that it was not correct to have the no-knock provision, but the judge in this case went on to say there were exigent circumstances to justify a no-knock entry, wouldn't the nighttime also be justified under the no-knock considerations?
I think I see what you're saying. You would have to resolve the exigency question, because the state alleges that that would justify a warrantless search. But the analysis is slightly different under both, only slightly different under the two questions, because the question under nighttime, if there's no authorization for a nighttime search, was whether the police were even allowed to be there on the premises doing what they did at all at night. And under just the no knock, the question is just, did what the police observed justify an unannounced entry? So the exit, and I do want to turn to the exigent circumstances question here, because I don't think that there's any way to get to, well, there is not any way to get to exigent circumstances justifying an unjustified nighttime or no knock, but I'm going to focus on the nighttime entry here for a few reasons. First of all, the district court based its ruling on the idea that the single factor of hot pursuit of a fleeing felon justified it. That clearly does not justify the search under the case law. There was no one outside that was fleeing that went into the residence. That was just clearly incorrect. The district court provided an alternative ground of the totality of the circumstances. And there's a few reasons that that can't apply in this case. First of all, one of the single most, if not the most critical factors under the totality analysis is that the police did in fact take 3 hours to plan this raid and to try to obtain a warrant. Under the police's own assessment of the situation, they had at least 3 hours to plan this search. And case law clearly identifies whether a search occurs as part of developments in the field or whether it was pre-planned as one of the most critical factors in whether exigent circumstances existed. I think as a matter of common sense to look at this and say the police gathered themselves, took 3 hours, planned a raid with multiple police officers and police cars and weapons and battering rams, that there were not exigent circumstances prior to them showing up to execute this nighttime raid. And then to the extent that anything that they observed inside the house would contribute to any exigency, first of all, that would only be one thing to look at in the totality of the circumstances. And I certainly wouldn't concede that seeing people moving inside the house and one person, as the officer testified, saying something about the cops, that's his quote, would create an exigency. To the extent that that was viewed at all, those movements and that statement about police presence, those things only occurred in response to the police showing up, surrounding the house, lighting the house up, and approaching it with a show of force, which police were not entitled to do, particularly at nighttime, without a valid nighttime authorization.
And so, counsel, can I ask, because I had the same question as Judge Werke, is whether the exigency, if found, would also would be a reason not to reverse based on a bad nighttime search. I'm trying to figure out where it all fits in with respect to the nighttime as opposed to the way analytically where it fits in. So like, let's assume that when they approach the house without a valid nighttime warrant and it's night, that the people inside say, you know, flush the drugs, and you hear it started. I mean, there's no question that evidence is being destroyed. I mean, how would that fit in analytically with respect to that they're there unlawfully at night?
Sure. Well, I think there's two answers to that. First of all, is that you would suppress under, regardless of whether there are exigent circumstances. And I'm glad you brought that up because I want to be clear that this is not just a violation of the Fourth Amendment in the Minnesota Constitution. This is also a violation of Minnesota statutes governing nighttime searches. And even if the constitutional exigency requirement or exigency exception exists, you still have the violation of state statute which under Jackson, given the facts of the case, is an independent ground to suppress the evidence in the case. So exigency can, if it's the nighttime issue, exigency can be set aside for that reason. State statute violation is an independent and sufficient ground to suppress the evidence. But second, regarding exigency, I think it's also important to be clear that what the police did in this case, if they did not have a valid nighttime authorization, was not reasonable conduct and can't support a finding of exigency. Kentucky versus King, the Supreme Court case, addressed this not too long ago. The question of when police show up and undertake actions that either violate the Fourth Amendment, violate the Constitution, or threaten to violate the Constitution, anything that police observe in response to that can't be used to create exigent circumstances. In Kentucky versus King, what the police did was they showed up at the door, they knocked on it, and they announced themselves. In that case, what the police did was reasonable, consistent with the Fourth Amendment of what any private citizen is permitted to do, and the evidence was not suppressed. In this case, the situation is completely opposite. Without a valid nighttime authorization, police showed up at this house after night had fallen at 11:30. It was completely dark with guns, battering rams, lights, multiple officers and cars surrounding the house. This is obviously outside of the bounds of what a private citizen might do, and it violated the Constitution, not to mention state statute. Anything that police observed in response to that conduct can't be used to rely on for exigency because it was the presence and show of force, not just the presence, I want to be clear, but it was the show of force and the actions on the part of the police that created that response in the people inside the house. So without a valid nighttime authorization, the police took part in conduct that would not have been legal without the nighttime authorization. That conduct created the response, and that response can't be relied on to turn around and then say, well, we viewed this response in response to our conduct, and so we could go in without a warrant.
May I ask factually, I know we're nearing the end of the time, if you don't mind, presiding judge. I want to understand specifically, I want a picture of what happens at the doorstep. You talk about the lights, you know, the lights are shining. When were the lights shining relative to them? I want to know what was happening, including with respect to the lights, relative and noise or whatever, relative to what the police saw when they're on the doorstep and seeing in the house. And this goes to the question of repose. Like, can you factually describe exactly what was happening around and what they saw?
Yes. So the first police officers that show up go around to the side and to the back of the house to secure the back door. They have guns. They have a canine with. It's still quiet at that point. The other officers haven't started their approach to the front door yet. Other officers show up, and this is in the district courts. And if the judge will let me go on just to answer, finish this question.
Yeah, you lost a little bit of time when you cut out. So please go ahead. And I'm curious about that, too. You described it as being lit up, and I wasn't real sure what you meant by that.
So the first officers to arrive go to the backyard. They have guns, of course, they have canine, they're in the backyard. Other officers show up, and this is in the testimony, I think the most clear kind of, and of course there's body camera videos in the record as well. I think the most clear testimony is the testimony of Officer Byrne at the omnibus hearing, who testifies that after the other officers who are there have secured the back door, his job was to be the first person through the front door accompanied by the battering ram. So he testifies, and this is backed up by the video, that he gets out of his car, he approaches the front door. You can see on the body cam videos that at that point, obviously their guns are drawn, and he testifies to that as well, and that there are floodlights and flashing lights pointed at the house at that point in time. And then he testifies that as he's approaching the front door, and he's accompanied by another officer.
I'm sorry, pointed at and on?
Well, you can see from the squad videos that there are lights that are illuminating the area.
Thank you.
That's the best way that I can describe it. No one, I don't think, testified about the lights, but it's apparent in the squad video. And the officer did testify that as he's approaching the front door, so obviously with his gun, with the battering ram, on the way to the front door at this point, that's when he testified that he believed he heard someone in the house say something about cops, and that he observed two other people inside the house running back and forth. And then he testified that then we entered the house. So again, that's the long and short of everything that was happening here. Police surround the house. There are multiple cars. They're approaching the house with guns and a battering ram, at which point then they say they saw these other motions inside the house that were later relied on to try to establish exigent circumstances.
Does that answer your question, Judge Smith?
Thank you, yes.
And Mr. Luzzo, you'll have your 5 minutes rebuttal. We'll turn to you, Mr. Hersey.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Scott Hersey. I represent the respondent in this case as an assistant Mahnomen County attorney. And I would suggest to the court that you can actually tie the exigent circumstances into the nighttime search here. But first, I would like to remind the court that the case law in Minnesota indicates that the issuance of nighttime search authorization and the issuance of an unannounced entry authorization are both given great deference under our case law, sort of like the Ventresca Gates great deference for probable cause. Again, I would remind the court that all that the officers have to show to the issuing magistrate is reasonable suspicion. That is something more than an unarticulated hunch that a nighttime search or unannounced entry is necessary for a successful search. And in this particular case, I would point out, as the district court mentioned specifically in its memorandum and findings, that all of the officers' observations from both the front of the house and the back of the house, both by Officer Hoglum in the front and another officer that was at the back of the house, that these observations were all made before the officers ever made it to the front door.
Right, I agree. What were the observations?
The observations that were made was, as the officer from the front door approached, he saw an individual, and the omnibus court assumed that that was Mr. Turner, the owner of the house, yell to alert the other people in the house, "Cops," and he started to move rapidly. The person at the officer at the back of the house made the specific observation that after that, two males came running towards the back of the house. He could see them through the back windows, and then they began to run towards the front of the house immediately after that.
Right, but you know.
And that was prior to the actual execution. I'm not hearing you, Judge.
I apologize. Let's say, for the sake of argument, we think that, you know, there wasn't grounds for the nighttime warrant. And let's also assume that, as Mr. Lozo pointed out, Mr. Repose, you know, it's not like the other cases where, you know, you have, it's clear that these people are up, you know, because there's people coming in, you know, there's loud music, you know, it's not your typical nighttime activity, which, you know, I don't know what the Supreme Court would say. I would assume that's either falling asleep or, you know, watching Colbert. So then all we've got is, okay, they're there at night when they're not supposed to. And if we assume, as Judge Smith was able to pin down, so there are lights pointed at the house, and you know, at that point, then all we have is cops and running back and forth. Well, you know, if I woke up in the middle of the night with flashlights against my house and it's surrounded by police, I think I'd run around and say, "The cops." Okay. And I'm not so sure that's enough for exigent circumstances. I think if it was, as again, Judge Smith pointed out, it's the cops, flush it all, you know, then I'd say battering ram away. But my problem is, I am growing more sympathetic to Mr. Lozo's argument that, you know, the exigence seems to have been in response to the violation of the nighttime. Well, no, that there are no exigent, there are not enough exigent circumstances. And whatever activity was being done was in response to an invalid nighttime search. So I've kind of laid that all out. Why am I wrong?
Well, let me start with the exigent circumstances first, Judge. I would submit there were exigent circumstances because the issue appears to be whether the officers had reasonable suspicion that knocking and announcing would be futile, or that there was a risk to themselves or a risk that someone may dispose of drugs, because after all, they were after heroin, which is easily disposed of. And as they approach, rather, once the homeowner sees them, homeowner just doesn't come to the door and open the door and say, "What can I do for you, officers? Why are you here?" He yells "cops" to alert the other three individuals in the residence. And in response to that, two of the others run like crazy, one of whom is found in a bathroom, which is a good place to dispose of drugs. And there is reasonable suspicion that they may try to escape. There was one or two officers at the back, but there were at least three windows on the back of the trailer house. There were other windows on the front and a door on the front. They may not have been able to stop the escape had some of these four people gone out different windows or doors with the limited coverage at the back. So I think there is reasonable suspicion of an exigency. And I would disagree respectfully with Mr. Lozo that This was caused by a Fourth Amendment violation of the police. They went out and did what they were supposed to do. They applied to a judge to get a search warrant. They established probable cause. They requested a nighttime search. They requested unannounced entry. And now they're just coming to execute a judicial order to search this residence. And it seems to me that they are not creating the exigency themselves. They are simply doing what they're authorized to do, which is to approach. And whatever they observed occurred before the actual search warrant. I would put the breach of the door as the execution of the search warrant, not the mere approach. If you're talking mere approach, you could be talking the police coming down the street a half a mile away. But secondly, I would point out, especially under exigent circumstances, since the trial, or excuse me, the omnibus court did in fact talk about the presence of firearms when it determined exigency here, there was the information from the first informant, I'll call that person a confidential informant, that that person was giving recent information and that that person had bought drugs at that trailer home, and that that person had seen a sawed-off shotgun by that front door, a very dangerous situation for the police officers. And I would submit that exigent circumstances were certainly justified by the circumstances that the officers faced when they got there, but additionally by the firearm. And I understand that the district court said initially in the warrant it shouldn't have authorized the exigent no-knock entry, but then when it found exigent circumstances at the actual residence itself, it did refer to the firearm. I think, going back to your question, Judge, that you can take that exigency, and the district court did not reach the issue of the gun when it was talking about a proper nighttime search. And I would submit that in State versus Wasson, and that in fact was an unannounced entry with exigent circumstances, the mere fact that there had been firearms found in the residence 3 months earlier and there was ongoing drug dealing was enough to establish exigent circumstances. And one of the things for exigent circumstances is to protect the searchers or the public. And in this particular situation, there was a strong need to protect the officers, and there was reasonable suspicion entitled to great deference that by approaching at nighttime, when they would not be as visible, when they assembled and got ready to execute the warrant, that provided some protection. And the surprise of appearing at night gave the people less time to get prepared and run off and grab a weapon or grab a weapon by a door. So I would submit that that firearm, considered in the exigent circumstances totality by the district court, is something that should have been considered by the court, and the court should have added that to the basis for the nighttime search when it did its memorandum. And so I would ask the court to consider that. Secondly, I would suggest to the court that there was no period of nighttime repose. And I would agree with Mr. Lozo that it's not determined solely by sleep. What the Supreme Court said in Jackson essentially was there are various reasons for the protections of the privacy of the nighttime. One of those is that people are not roused out of bed in the middle of the night. Secondly, so they don't have to stand in their night clothes while their home is searched. And third, so it doesn't interfere with the privacy of nighttime activities. And when you have a situation where one of the people in the house attempts to alert everyone else by shouting that the cops are there, when you have two of the other people, one of which was the appellant, are running from one end of the trailer home to another, and there's no indication that anyone was in their night clothes, this is clearly not a period of nighttime repose that would be.
So, counsel, may I ask on that issue then, even under that theory, if they had been asleep and then awakened and ran and said cops and ran, they wouldn't be in repose even though they were asleep, because they then said in response to seeing them, obviously, evidently, because they say cops, so they must have seen them or heard them and then seen them, that would no longer be repose?
Well, I sleep is probably not determinative as I read Jackson, Judge, but...
No, I know it's not. I'm just trying to pick something that we know for sure is repose, but then they run and yell cops. Because we don't really know what they were doing before they said cops and ran, right?
That's true. But I think the specific time we need to look at is when the officers execute the warrant. And simply approaching the house or lighting up the house, I respectfully disagree with Mr. Lozo that that's executing the warrant. That's all perfectly.
That's my question. So under your analysis, is if they were sleeping up until the moment that they yelled cops and ran, you're saying, well, that they're not in repose at the moment of execution, therefore we don't have a nighttime problem.
I would say that, but I would also respectfully suggest, Judge, that the fact that someone was looking out the front of the house and saw the officers as they approached suggests that they weren't asleep. And the fact that the two men were running from one end to the trailer to the other immediately after that, according to the officer at the back of the house, suggests that none of those individuals were sleeping. And yelling cops certainly alerted the third the one female in the residence to the fact that the police were there. So
we talked about detail about the facts. Do you have, with respect to the facts, what was established, I guess, with respect to when the moment that cops was yelled, were the lights on the house, how close? You're talking about, I think we've talked about where they're at the front door, or you're saying approaching the front door. Do you have a more specific factual description of where the officers were relative to the front door when that was yelled?
I don't, and I don't disagree significantly with Mr. Lozo that they were on their approach and they may have had their firearms at the ready and lights going.
Does approach mean that they're at the sidewalk or they're at their front door to you? What does an approach mean?
That I don't know.
Okay.
But I will point out to you that the district court found it was significant and put it in the district court's memo that all of the observations of these individuals running around, even going to the back of the house and coming back to the front, all occurred before the officers reached that front door. And that is the moment of the execution of the search warrant where the officers breached the front door and entered. And I don't think you can say that the search warrant was commenced when the officers were on the street or as the officers approached the particular house. And again, I would suggest that for the unannounced entry, the district court went through a careful analysis under State versus Lonas, concluded that this was a grave offense. It involved an ongoing sale of heroin, frequent trips to Chicago by the individual known as Thor, and it included the fact that the occupants were believed to be armed by the officers. That information, even though the date wasn't specified, it was referred to as recent by that first confidential informant, and probable cause had already been found. And the acts of everyone fleeing in the residence caused concerns of potential escape, potentially getting a weapon, which the officers believed was there, or destroying some of the evidence, which is easily destroyed. Secondly, depending on how the court reaches its decision, I'm not sure the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Hudson versus Michigan makes it necessary to suppress the fruits of a search, even if there had been a violation of the knock and announce rule. And I would ask this court to give great deference to the determination of the district court when it found that there was in fact reasonable suspicion, more than just an unarticulated hunch, that this ongoing pipeline of drug sales from Chicago to Nativash would have the amounts decreased or gone if they did not execute this at night. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hersey. Mr. Lozo, you have the last word.
Thank you. So first of all, I would focus on the fact that, of course, deference to the magistrate isn't unlimited, and where there were no facts establishing any need to search, particularly at night, this court, of course, should not defer to that decision. And regarding exigency, it's the state's burden to show there is no deference to the determination of exigency. In that case, it's the state's burden to show that there was such a compelling need to enter at that point in time that the warrant requirement should be dispensed with. Second of all, there's some discussion, of course, about when the people inside reacted to the show of force by police. This court certainly doesn't need to engage in any fine parsing about when the actual moment of execution of the warrant was, because there are two different grounds for the police conduct here to, that it can be shown that the police conduct caused the
reaction. Sorry, I'm muted. Mr. Lozo, why would we not be concerned about when the warrant was executed? Because we had a warrant that was, a warrant request comes in, district court says, okay, there's probable cause. So wouldn't we need to be concerned about that? I mean, these officers had the right to approach the trailer.
Okay, two responses. First of all I mean is that you don't need to determine what the word execution means. What the case law requires is whether the people were reacting to a Fourth Amendment violation or to a threatened Fourth Amendment violation. Here, without a valid nighttime authorization, what the police did, their show of force surrounding the house, was a Fourth Amendment violation because the public couldn't do that and the police didn't have a valid warrant authorizing them to do that. Also, their threat with the battering ram and guns to enter the house under Kentucky versus King is also a threatened Fourth Amendment violation without a valid warrant. So under either ground, the conduct of the people inside doesn't create an exigency. And I think the other part of your question is, well, if the cops thought they had a good warrant letting them do this, why should we suppress? And the answer to that question is, first of all, that same argument for, well, if the police believed that they had a warrant authorizing them to do this, the evidence shouldn't be suppressed, was expressly rejected in Jackson. And I think it makes sense because it makes sense not only because it was rejected in Jackson, but because that's simply an articulation of the Leon good faith exception that Minnesota courts have repeatedly refused to adopt. And so any exception that would say, well, if a warrant is issued, it doesn't matter what happens after that, because whether the warrant is good or not, the evidence doesn't need to be suppressed, would of course turn suppressionary analysis on its head and would provide very little incentive for the government to comply with search and seizure requirements and with the Constitution and with the statute governing these. So it is true that the police did take the 3 hours to try to obtain a valid warrant, but they weren't able, as this court should recognize, to give the district court, or they didn't give the district court, sufficient facts to indicate that a nighttime search was necessary. That nighttime search was incorrectly authorized. This court should conclude that there was no basis for that nighttime search, which, because there's no facts in the warrant indicating that a nighttime search is necessary.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to make sure I understand, again, the analysis and what your perspective is, especially with respect to the statutory basis and the constitutional basis. So the statutory basis for the nighttime search, you would acknowledge that repose is an issue there, right, under Jackson, right? Okay, to show the seriousness of the violation. So if you have to show that, or state has to show that they weren't in repose, I guess. And then there's a statutory violation. And you're saying if there's a statutory violation, are you saying that the exigency doesn't matter because that's a constitutional issue, not a statutory one? Like, in other words, does an exigency overcome the statutory violation or no?
No, I wouldn't say so. I think this court can certainly, and should, if there's a violation of the statute, which there is, that seriously subverts the purpose of the statute, that's an independent ground under statutory law, which is recognized in Jackson and in other binding cases, to suppress the evidence. And constitutional arguments about exigency that apply to Fourth Amendment violations wouldn't apply, because you're talking about a state statute and you're talking about suppression in response to the state statute violation.
As to that, is there authority saying that the concept that the exigency constitutional issue does not apply to a statutory one? Question.
Well, the authority. I
don't know if Jack dealt
sense.
With.
I think that makes sense as a logical matter, because the exigency doctrine is a Fourth Amendment doctrine. So when you're looking at the statutory violation, which is a separate, of course, related but separate issue, whether that statute was violated and then whether suppression is required. Suppression looks at whether the violation was whether the statute was seriously subverted, and that's in Jackson and other cases. And here, where you have the search occurring late at night, no evidence that the people aren't in repose, and obviously a particularly forceful search late at night, that serious subversion of the statute leads to suppression, even if a different constitutional argument would apply to the constitutional claim.
Thank you to both counsel. The matters were well briefed and very well argued. We will take the matter under advisement and a decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you.